So let's begin with a bow. Welcome everyone, to new people, welcome. And some I didn't meet from last week, I was in New York.
So why do we do this?
Why do we do this?
Why do we do this?
What's it mean? When we bow, it's an acknowledgement of wisdom meeting wisdom. So we see the other person's wisdom, and we recognize our own sacredness as well. So we're actually joining the left and right sides of our body, and the left side is the wisdom aspect, and the right side is skillful means or compassion. And so when we join our hands together, we're joining the wisdom and the compassion aspect. And actually, the actual mudra is slightly open, so it's as if there's room for something there as an offering. So it's not like jammed together like this, but slightly open, and it's from the heart. So the bow is an acknowledgement of our own wisdom and the wisdom of others. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it's basically like you have rightly said it. Like it's like it's a namaste in Sanskrit, and it's just like honoring the light within you. That's what it is. Like in the simple words, we can say whatever light I have, like the spirit which is within me, I with full respect and honor, I just bow down and give honor to that light within you. So with that, we are each other giving a blessing, and just we are honoring each other's life, and we are recognizing that.
Good. That's a good way to come together also when we begin. Thank you for that. So tonight, we're talking about chapter 18 in this book, The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times. And this will be the last night that we'll be working with this book. This is Module 2, Class 6. We've been dividing our classes into 6 weeks. So this is the last class on this particular module in this book. So last week, Michael taught on the 6 paramitas. I taught before on the first 3, and Michael reviewed and covered the last 3. And tonight the teaching is on groundlessness. And this is also the paramita that is the 6th paramita, which we haven't really talked about too much, also called prajna paramita, or superior knowledge or transcendent knowledge. So that's why we actually decided to present the Sutra of the Heart of Transcendent Knowledge. Because this is what Pema is talking about here, although the text of that I don't think is in this book. So now you have the root of what she was presenting. So just to give a little overview here, the word sutra means a teaching by the Buddha. So that means actual words of the Buddha. And the heart here refers to the heart of the Mahayana teachings, which is emptiness, or shunyata in Sanskrit. And it's a teaching also, it's called here transcendent knowledge. Again, that's prajna paramita. So that has to do with going beyond. And we'll see what that really means within this chant. So this particular chant, you may have heard it through other traditions, particularly the Zen tradition, Thich Nhat Hanh, Japanese Zen, Chinese Zen, Korean Zen, and the Tibetan teachers use this a lot. So it's considered this is a Mahayana teaching. So that falls within the Maha meaning great and Yana meaning vehicle or path. So we've used this word before in our classes. And Mahayana is the path of compassionate activity. And it talks about emptiness and compassion and the way of working in the world in a compassionate way. So just to give you a little background, this particular teaching was, as I said, given by the Buddha, and it took place in India, in northeast India, in Rajgir, I guess is now the town, but it was called Rajagriha, I believe, at that time. So I think I'd like to just start and go through this, and you can interrupt at any point and ask questions. It's a very profound teaching. The Mahayana path, we speak of it, is profound and vast. And the profundity part has to do with emptiness. So it's as if you looked at the ocean, and the ocean is very deep and profound. That's the emptiness quality of the teachings. And it's also very vast. So the vastness is compassion. So we talk about compassionate activity as being very vast. So those two come together in the activity of compassionate action. So to begin, I mentioned the title, The Sutra of the Heart of Transcendent Knowledge. And it begins with, Thus Have I Heard. So that's sort of a clue in to this is going to be the words of the Buddha, and somebody wrote it down. So that's pretty simple. Once the Blessed One, so the Blessed One is the Buddha, was dwelling in Rajagriha at Vulture Peak Mountain. And Vulture Peak Mountain, it sounds very quite grand. I was actually there. It's not very big. So India is pretty much a flat plain, I guess, with hills. Where I was, the Ganges basin there is very flat. And this is a hill, I would say, not that high, but it's quite dramatic because if you're living in a land that's just everything is flat, when you get slightly above that, there's a view. So this is the story of how the Buddha taught these profound teachings on emptiness. So once the Buddha was dwelling in Rajagriha at Vulture Peak Mountain, and it's actually called that because these rocks look like vultures, you know how they have their wings up, and so this rock formations that look like that, they're just sort of these jagged rocks that stick out. And just as an aside, the monkeys are unbelievable. They look like these wisdom beings. They just look at you with these eyes, and they just, like they're listening. So when you go up there and chant or something, I'm sure they've heard it all before.
They look, oh, here's the
heart of it. Here they are.
The heart of
it. Right, I've heard this once before, or 100 times. So, so he's up there together with a great gathering of the Sangha of monks. A Sangha is a community of monks, and a great gathering of the Sangha of Bodhisattvas. And the Bodhisattvas are the awakened beings, or you could say they have some realization. At that time, the Buddha entered the Samadhi. So the Samadhi we talked about last week, Michael talked about it as the fifth paramita, which is meditative equipoise. So a level of meditative stability that expresses the Dharma called profound illumination. And at the same time, the noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva. So Avalokiteshvara is the name of this great, Maha is great, Sattva is being. So this great being also was in the same state of meditation. So he and the Buddha were both settling down for a good meditation, and everybody else is around them. So the word Avalokiteshvara, there's also, you've probably heard of Kuan Yin. That's the Chinese equivalent of Avalokiteshvara.
So,
yes, the goddess of compassion. So it's shown in that particular tradition in the female form. But it's the same basic energy. So at the same time, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, while practicing the profound Prajna Paramita, saw in this way. He saw the five skandhas to be empty of nature. So this will be highlighted more as we go on, but the five skandhas, again, will be teachings that we'll give coming up. So we haven't really gone into that detail yet. Then through the power of the Buddha, Venerable Shariputra said to Noble Avalokiteshvara. So the Buddha is basically resting in this meditative state during this whole teaching. And you could say, how is it that these are words of the Buddha if he doesn't say a word? Now, there's a good question. But he is in a very awake state, and he's able to convey this awake mind and know what's going on, because we know this from the end when he says good, good to Avalokiteshvara. So he's awake. He's not speaking the words, but he is basically conveying the words through Avalokiteshvara. And also, we see this Venerable Shariputra who speaks up. He has a question. So the Venerable Shariputra said to Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, how should a son or daughter of noble family train who wishes to practice the profound Prajna Paramita? So this is his question, and I'd like to pause here for a moment because it's very, I think it's a very important point. There is a student who has a question, and because the student raises a question, this teaching arises. So this inquiry is part of the way that, well, this is through inquiry and investigation, the student learns, but also causes the teachings to come forth. So that's a little clue for everyone to ask questions, because it actually helps us. It helps your fellow students, because if you have a question and wonder about something, it's very likely that someone else has the same question, and it's an offering to ask. So that's a little plug for keeping things, you know, charged up and lively. So Shariputra is really key to this whole teaching. So he asked this question, and how should a son or daughter of noble family, so again, noble, I think in this case, we're talking about this community, this monastic community, the noble family train, who wishes to practice the profound Prajnaparamita. So this is the fundamental question. So it's beyond the monastic community, obviously. It's actually anyone at this point here.
Why is there a distinction that a noble would train differently than anybody else?
I think it's just speaking of the the Buddha as noble, or Avalokiteshvara as noble Avalokiteshvara. So I think it's not so much to make a distinction. Does anyone comment?
Yes, it actually has to do with engaging on the path. Uh-huh. So when we go in the earlier stages of training in Buddhism, which is traditionally called Hinayana, or which is practiced more frequently or ostensibly in Southeast Asia, one engages in the Vinaya, the Pratimoksha. These are the vows and the taking on. You're entering the path through various stages. And as you gain a foothold into the relationship to the Dharma, you embark on this noble path. And so a person who is engaged in that is considered noble. The word in Sanskrit is Arya. Mm-hmm. And Arya actually refers to, in this case, someone who is actually working on himself or herself and achieving a basic sense of liberation. They're discovering their own Buddha nature, they're committing themselves to the path, and they're also committing themselves to a harmless life, a life of moral rectitude and of basic goodness, which they share in themselves and with each other. So that's what constitutes the meaning of noble here.
Thank you.
There's no special blood.
No, it's not noble born.
It's strictly to do with a person's own working on oneself and developing merit and wisdom.
So please ask questions as we go along.
What does it mean to be a noble family?
Well, I think I interpret that to be the family of those that are practicing with the Buddha. Do you have another comment on that?
I mean, in some cases it refers specifically to monastics because they have basically sworn off their involvement or engagement with the world of what's called samsara. We'll go into that later. It's complicated. And in that process, but it actually refers to a practitioner. It refers to a person who is a Buddhist practitioner. And so anyone who is a Buddhist practitioner has embarked on the path and taken some preliminary vows, specifically. Mm-hmm. When you take refuge vows, that would be your first steps into becoming a member of the noble family. And then later, we'll be taking bodhisattva vows, which have to do further with the teachings that come here and what they actually spur, a commitment to work for the benefit of all beings and not work for one's own self-liberation alone. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Okay. You had a question?
Are your semantically noble to sound elitist?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you're trying to
speak. No, it's not. It's more... It's sort of, I guess, sort of honorable, or it's when you think of someone who's committing to this path of compassion, it's you're taking a leap into this kind of generosity and working with others.
But then I guess the question really is, then why say noble? Why can't it just be a son or daughter who wishes to practice?
Because it actually means you have done it. It doesn't mean you've just done. Wished it. You're
right.
Actually taking steps to do it.
Because you're already
doing it.
There's a difference between
mm-hmm.
you know, saying, oh,
difference.
Great, I'd love to meditate. And never meditate.
There's a big difference.
And actually engaging.
Right. Yes, engaging on the path.
Really already on the path, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right. addressed in this way, Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, said to Venerable Shariputra. So here's the answer, and it goes on for a while. So this is how to train in transcendent knowledge, or Prajnaparamita. O Shariputra, a son or daughter of noble family who wishes to practice the profound Prajna Paramita should see in this way, seeing the five skandhas to be empty of nature. So here's where there's a delineation of the five skandhas. So the first one is form, and then the next sentence after that is feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness. Those are the five skandhas. And again, this is part of the Hinayana teachings, and we'll be going into that again more. So this is, so he says, form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, perception, formation and consciousness or emptiness. So it's the same pattern with all of them.
What is emptiness?
What?
So what is emptiness?
Emptiness sounds like it means something different from what I think of as emptiness. Nothing being there.
Okay, so that is what we think. When we use the English word emptiness, we think of nothingness, but that's not what it is. Emptiness is potentiality. So if you think of the space that's open, and all things are possible within open space. That's emptiness. Things that can arise from that space.
So emptiness, in a sense, is like a white canvas ready to accept paint.
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, no, that's too causative.
Potentially.
It has to do with the fundamental innate essence of things, the essence of everything, which is not separate from what they are. Mm-hmm. The essence and the actual emanation are inseparable. So, in the sense of emptiness, if we read this chapter on groundlessness, it has to do with a completely open dimension of being, which is completely beyond concept. And this is, of course, difficult to grasp because we're always trying to
beyond concept.
Reify. There's a word in English, a wonderful word, reify, and it means to turn something into a thing. When we are actually engaging in, perceiving, which is prajna, the word prajna, which we looked at last week, we're actually discerning the nature of reality, and this is emptiness. Emptiness simply means it is beyond the grasp of mind. It is beyond the grasp of conceptual mind, which is always trying to turn in something into a thing, make deep freeze it, and put it into a box and say, okay, I have it now.
Right.
You can't do that with emptiness.
So is emptiness kind of like there's not a way to say what this is?
Right,
Emily,
exactly.
Emily's going to talk about a lot of this.
Right,
yeah.
So exactly.
Is it wrong to say emptiness is infinite?
Anything we say about it is wrong. So that's the whole teaching. And if you're confused, good. Because that's what it's about. And if I have to talk about it, too bad, because this is the hardest thing I've ever had to figure out. And I can't figure it out. Or there's the potential. I know it's there. But it's really, it's not this, it's not that. And then if you think it's that, it's not that. And if you think it's that, it's not that. And the idea is that you're cutting away all of your concepts and your illusions about it. And if you look at the context in which this teaching was given, the Buddha trained these monastics, and they had lots of rules. So don't do this, don't pee on the grass. That was one of them, actually. There are all these rules. And you're not supposed to do this and that. And everyone, there are very specific teachings about how the world appears and what is happening. And so the sense was that they were getting more and more solidified in their view. And the Buddha was teaching more teachings to try to cut away that view. But this one went even deeper. So this teaching was so profound that every step of the way, when you try to say it's this, it's not that. And Pema really describes it, I think, very well in here. If you've read this chapter, she talks about if you went to see the Buddha and you thought, you know, well, now I've got it. Form is emptiness. No, that's not it. And then when you go and talk to the Buddha and say, well, now I've got it, emptiness also is form. No, that's not it. And then, oh, I've got it. Everything's both empty and not empty simultaneously. And the Buddha said, nope, that's not it either. And you're getting more and more frustrated, right? And then the next one is, there's only one other answer. The nature of reality is that it neither exists nor doesn't exist. It's neither form nor emptiness. And we feel good. It is a beautiful groundless answer. But the Buddha says, no, that's too limited an understanding. Maybe at this point, his no is such a shock that we experience the wide open mind of Prajnaparamita, the mind that is satisfied with no resting place at all. So it's constant, it's just cutting away and cutting away. But the inquiry and the asking then can take us to a place that's more open, or that just opens by itself. I think that's what we're being asked to lean into here.
Is that only if we're denied an answer every single time we ask?
If we're denied an answer?
You have to hear no to keep asking more questions. You keep hearing no, and only then
Do you get there? Is that...
I think the no, yes, I think the no is an important part of being able to get to the point of keep asking. You don't have to ask somebody. You can ask yourself. You can inquire yourself. It's a self, you can awaken by just this level of inquiry and working with this. There's a lot of contemplation that can happen here. But not getting an answer is, at some point, there's a breakthrough. That's the way it's taught. And I think it's very similar to the Zen tradition with the Zen koan tradition, although I've never personally experienced that myself. I don't know.
Let me make an attempt. I'll try to explain you with what I have read and heard from Osho. So it's more about like a little story. Like I think around 1.5 minutes probably to explain that. It's more about like think about like in God is there and there is a court of law where God is sitting. Okay. Now there is a lawsuit which is being presented in front of God that the light and darkness have never met. So now God calls like, okay, light, please come and present your case in front of me. Light comes, presents it, like, okay, I'm there, I'm like, it's all about like, wherever I go, it's more about people can see. Okay, great. Now, how to make like other evidences? So these are the evidences which was presented there. The next one, like, now the case is like they have never met. So you cannot bring a witness or both the parties together. So darkness need to be, again, he comes and comes in front of God and he puts his argument, his kind of evidences, like, yes, wherever I go, there is all darkness, nobody can see. So this is known to us by Newton. We know that absence of light is darkness. So now, as a God, God can see. God can see both the perspectives. Like there is a light, there is darkness. They do exist and there is something like from a keyhole, if light passes through, there is a meeting point, but you cannot express that. God can sense it, witness it. That's what is the emptiness. You know, but you cannot say it. You know that answer is light, in front of light, what I am going to answer. As a God, I need evidence to say in front of light that it comes in absence of you only. And when there is a darkness, in front of darkness, we need to say this light comes in absence of you. So as a God, you would know, but you would not be in a position of answering that. That's what is the point which has been expressed as an emptiness. You would not be able to express anything in words. So with this perspective, I'm trying to put it forward, like what that emptiness is being expressed here. It's more kind of being observing all the things, you know, all the three perspectives are right in all places. Light is right because really they have not met. Darkness is right. God is also right because he knows, like it's an absence because both have come in front of them, the God.
Now, how do you get beyond God, no God, and light and dark completely? Those are all ideas.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's not it.
One of the things that Buddhism is predicated on is no self. No self nature. And we went through this earlier about producing teachings about no self, no personal self, reality and reality. And so the early students of the Buddha were convinced that they understood the nature of self-liberation, meaning no self nature, emptying what they call emptiness of self. But the big shock, which is what we're discussing here, is emptiness of other, which means all phenomena have no self-nature. Not only does the subject have no self-nature, but the object has no self-nature. That's much more radical and much more kind of profound and vast in terms of its reach.
Okay, so now we should ask questions rather than give explanations, I think.
Well, it's helpful, though. Yeah. I think it's okay.
It is.
Yeah. It's helpful.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name.
Manish.
When you were doing the explanation, I had my eyes closed, and when you were talking about darkness and light coming together, I felt this thing in my body. It was like, I don't have to defend myself. I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to understand you. You don't have to understand. It felt like I could set aside this ego thing that gets me in such trouble. That, with your explanation, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but I don't need to defend it. that's what it, I could feel that inside. It was, wow, and I got just a second of rest. And I don't know if that is what it is. You know, it felt like you're faced with darkness. I didn't need to judge it. And vice versa, because I put myself in two places at once. And
it's like this.
Of course, I can just like that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And so where is God in that? That part of just the partnership, just
the one who can have all the three perspectives, right? That you can observe that there is light, because God as a soul, as a spirit, you can make sense of that, like there is a light, there is a darkness, there is a God. Like, so in all this, like, you can consider soul part of it, who is observing that event which is happening.
Okay,
and
so
which has got
knowledge.
All the knowledge,
yeah.
Full like wisdom of what is this is happening.
So it seems to me now that my question is a moot point, because if I'm there, I don't need to know who's who, because I'm there.
Yeah. It's that's what like Emily, whatever, she's also trying to. It's like, again, one more thing I would like to add. Like, there is sugar. We eat, then only we can say it's sweet.
Right.
It's an experience. So unless and until, like, if sugar is in front of me, I take it in my mouth, I would say, okay, Michael has told me, Emily has told me it is sweet. But unless and until I pick it up and take a little bite of it, I cannot say that sugar is sweet. So that's what is a part of Buddha. We keep getting into a seeker mode, which, rightly, I don't know the name.
Michael.
So he also made a point, like, noble family. We need to be on a seeker path, and all the vows and all kind of things align ourselves to that path. So there are stages, because these questions, I've made an attempt, it may make sense for few of us, it may not make sense, because there is always would be a rational mind. But if we keep getting into it, probably that sugar taste kind of a thing, we will eventually get to that point. We'll taste that sugar.
And you can't explain to anyone what it,
yes,
what it is.
Yeah.
So it's a personal experience of contact or understanding. So in this case, it's really without concept. So that's why Pema talks about the boat, that in the beginning of one of the other chapters on the Paramitas, I think that's where it was. She talks about the boat actually dissolving in the water. So we talk about the transcendent knowledge, the paramita, going from one shore to another and being sort of this transcendent knowledge. But really, she talked about the boat actually dissolving, that you're not actually arriving at another shore in a way. your ground, the ground under you dissolves, and this groundless quality of nothing to hold on to is what this teaching on the heart of transcendent knowledge is really the primary message here is what's being expressed is there's nothing left to hold on to, because every single teaching of the Buddha here from the beginning is listed, and he's saying it's not that. And you think, oh my gosh, I study with the Buddha for how long? And this is what we learned in our monastic class or whatever, and I've learned all this, and now it's not this. Especially if you look down with suffering, the Four Noble Truths is like the beginning of the teachings of the Buddha. The Four Noble Truths, that life is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's cessation of suffering, and a path. Those were so important in the Buddha's teachings, right from the beginning. And I can just picture these people on the mountain there listening to this teaching and thinking, wait a minute, that's not what he said, you know, 3 weeks ago. There's no end of old age and death, no suffering, no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path, no wisdom. Wait a minute, what am I doing? Why am I spending all this time doing this? No attainment and no non-attainment. But this next section is just amazing, I think. Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of prajnaparamita. So that I think he's saying here that so it's not attainment or not non-attainment, but they abide or they live in this space of emptiness. They live in this space where things aren't fixed, where there's complete openness and freedom, because it's beyond concept and beyond solidification.
Who's the they?
They?
So they live this way.
The bodhisattvas, yeah.
Us.
Us, and oh, us. They yeah. is us, right. Us. This is us. This next line, since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. And to me, this is one of the most important sections of this teaching. So the obscuration of mind, this is our conceptual mind and our solidification and our view. And we've been talking about it as bodhicitta is the seed of awakening and the clouds covering the bodhicitta. So the teaching of bodhicitta or Buddha nature is that we all have this awakened potential within us, and the clouds that cover it, these are our conceptual mind and emotional upheavals. And it says, since there's no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. So what do you make of that, and why would there be no fear? Because this is really an important teaching right here. Because I think when we think about why are we bothering to meditate? Why do we look for something? What are we looking for? Some sense of peace, understanding, freedom from fear, and some realization. But what does this mean? And why is this obscuration of mind in relation to fear? There is no fear.
Does it mean that? It seems to me what makes one suffer and fearful is the stuff that goes on in the mind. And if my mind is clear and it's just not there, I can proceed without fear, and I can proceed, I guess, without suffering. But there's something about the mind that makes it really hard to go forward, because it brings fear and suffering and can stop you. Is that
I think partly.
Pardon?
Partly. But it's a solidification. Go ahead.
So the other part is sometimes the fear is of loss, fear of losing, fear of what could happen. And if there's an emptiness and there, you know, there's a groundlessness, then you've already let go. Mm-hmm. Like you're not holding on, so there's nothing to lose. You're not mm-hmm. holding.
Right.
Well, also, besides the emotional, there's a like a self-preservation around your own lifeblood, your body. That fear protects you from withstanding. If you're on fire, for example, you'll do something about it. It's your fear of death that's preventing you from just sitting there and accepting it.
Well, it's not about not taking action to preserve our body, and it's because I think, I mean, when the house is burning, we should leave, obviously. We got to get out of there. But the fear is holding on to this solidification of ourself and always trying to create a situation where we feel secure and comfortable and...
So it is rooted in just emotion, feeling and self-worth and confidence. It's not physical.
I think you were right. Our concepts always have to do with the past and the future, and there's no fear if we're simply doing exactly what has to be done. And with that regard to echoes of what could happen, what did happen, then I think that actually we've gone beyond our concept then. The concepts are clouding us. And at the moment there's no fear. There's no idea other than doing what's actually... Our intelligence is functioning without concept.
Is that instinct?
What?
Is that like instinct?
If it's higher instinct, yes. If it's the instinct for self-protection, no.
No.
So the word instinct needs to be somewhat...
Intuition.
Intuition?
Intuition.
Intuition.
Yeah.
Something like, we say common sense. So what is that common sense comes from? Like we all can recognize certain things, certain way we could do certain things. And all of a sudden like something pops up from our heart or the mind, like, okay, if we do this way, probably this would be right. So that's a absolute wisdom, which for a moment of second, we have access to it, and that turns into the form of an intuition. Mm-hmm.
So that sounds like a shift from thinking to being.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It reminds me, actually, of a story I read about... creativity and problem solving, that there was firefighters were dropped onto this mountain. I don't know if anyone, this took place a while back, a long time ago, and they didn't realize how fast the fire was going to move up the mountainside, and so some of the firefighters just tried to run and get to this other area where they felt they could be safe. But this one person realized how fast the fire was going, and he just laid down on the earth, and he had a little water or something, or he had something over his nose, and the fire just went right over him. It went so fast, and he was the only one that survived. So that moment was just awake. He was just awake, and, I mean, it wasn't a response that you would at first think of, but... He laid down on the earth, and that saved him. So
he could have been wrong, and the others could have been right, and it would have still been the same.
There's no guarantee.
There's no guarantee. That's
no,
true.
It's an interesting point.
Yeah. Well. This is difficult to understand. It's, and I can't say that I really get it. So it's difficult to kind of chew on. But that's, I think that's the point, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. I think we can all feel it's okay that we don't get it, including me. So I'd sit up here, but I also struggle to understand, to really understand this on a very deep level. This is very profound. So the mantra is Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. And that's Om, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone way beyond, awake, so be it. So this is the Prajna Paramita mantra, and sometimes that is repeated also as a mantra. In this case, we just say it once. And so then Shariputra, so that's the end of the teaching. Thus Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should train in the profound Prajna Paramita. So the basic teaching here is how to train in this transcendent knowledge. And I think it's really about contemplating all these no's. And in fact, this book called The Heart Attack Sutra, I thought this was pretty good. And in fact, this is by Carl Brunholz. He's a really great teacher. He's coming to Connecticut. The end of this month is actually the Ferry Beach weekend, I'm sorry to say, but Michael and I are going to go to see him. And he wrote this book, and one of his students said, oh, though he called it the Heart Attack Sutra. So this is because many of the story is some of the people that heard this teaching had heart attacks because it was so shocking that they had to give up so much. They just couldn't stand it and they had heart attacks. So anyway, I saw him and I said, oh, well, thanks for your book. I read it and then I had a heart attack. And he said, oh, no. But anyway, this is really, this is very well, the heart, if you want something to explain the Heart Sutra more in more detail, this is really excellent. And we'll put the title of this up on our website. So I don't know why I brought that up, because I had some thought in mind, but now that's gone. But what's that?
Impermanence.
Impermanence. Yes. Well, you really know that when you get older. Those thoughts just disappear and you go, now, where was that? But that's okay. They say we get wiser as we get older, right? Even though we forget things.
We don't remember it.
Right, it goes into emptiness.
Can I ask something from a few lines before that?
Yes, go ahead.
Mentions all of the Vedas of the three times.
Mm-hmm. The three times are the past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should read the where we left off. We have some time, so we don't need to skip so much. Form is emptiness. Emptiness also is form. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness are emptiness. Thus, Shariputra, all dharmas are emptiness. And this word dharma here means phenomena. All phenomena are emptiness. There are no characteristics. There is no birth and no cessation. There is no impurity and no purity. And so that was a big deal in India in terms of what's pure and what's impure. And the untouchables and all these castes. So, I mean, every concept, I mean, everything people believed in here, he's cutting it away. There is no decrease and no increase. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no appearance, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no dharmas, no I-dhatu. And the word dhatu means space or realm. up to no mind dhatu, no dhatu of dharmas, no mind consciousness dhatu, no ignorance, no end of ignorance, up to no old age and death, no end of old age and death, no suffering, no origin of suffering. So right before that is a teaching that's called the 12 Nidanas, and this has to do with karma, and that's another teaching that we can get into at another point. And then here is no suffering. These are the Four Noble Truths. No suffering, no origin of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path, no wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of prajna paramita. Since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. They transcend falsity and attain complete nirvana. Nirvana is awakening. All the Buddhas of the three times, by means of prajna paramita, fully awaken to unsurpassable, true, complete enlightenment. Therefore, the great mantra of prajna paramita, the mantra of great insight, the unsurpassed mantra, the unequaled mantra, the mantra that calms all suffering, should be known as truth, since there is no deception. The prajna paramita mantra is said in this way: Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Swaha. Thus, Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound prajna paramita. And that's the end of what Avalokiteshvara is saying. Then the Blessed One arose from that samadhi and praised Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, saying, "Good, good, O son of noble family. Thus it is, O son of noble family. Thus it is. One should practice the profound prajna paramita just as you have taught, and all the Tathagatas will rejoice." And here, Tathagata means all the Buddhas. So,
Emily?
Yes.
You
I'm sorry. I didn't
have
see
about
it.
A million questions right now.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
I don't know if what I'm getting out of this is right. I got basically that the Buddha's teaching themselves can cause obscuration of the mind and get in the way of becoming awakened. The Buddha's teaching themselves, is that what he's
the
trying
Buddha's,
to say here?
Buddha's
the Buddha's teaching themselves can get in the way of becoming awakened.
Sure.
Is that
anything,
uh-huh.
Anything.
Yeah, any
anything
teaching.
At all.
Is this him just like trying to blow the ball
yes,
away?
Yes, yeah. Everything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That doesn't mean yeah. they aren't worth something.
Right, no, they're valuable.
That is, they're worth learning, they're worth practicing, and then...
And then
going on.
Right, but not hanging on to. That's the point. There's nothing to hang on to. It's letting go. It's a profound teaching of letting go. Letting go, letting go.
Is it sort of like the idea there's this path, and the path, you sort of head, like, it would be good to head this way. But if you think that looking at the ground you're walking on is enlightenment, then you're missing the point of
yeah.
Well, that's only when you get to Vajrayana.
Well, okay.
We won't go there.
No, but, well, the path is worth walking on, but then thinking that that path is a sense of saving oneself is a problem, so you have to.
So it serves the ground.
It becomes the ground, then it's time to do something else. So until one can finally abide by no ground whatsoever. So it's successive stages of stripping away, and at every point we have to give up more of our ideas about what we're. First of all, conventional ideas. Then the ideas we've used to replace the conventional ideas.
And then the next one, then the next one. I'm a this or I'm a that. All of that.
I have attainment. Okay, you have to give up attainment. Now I have to give up non-attainment. That's what it says.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. At the same time, we are obviously, we see there's a possibility of a path and awakening, and we can see that meditation, you know, hopefully it seems like there's some benefit in it, so from our view, we do our best to practice in some way to move along the path. But if we think we're getting somewhere here, no.
Yeah. I'm wondering why the monks just didn't get up and leave, because, like, at that point, like, I think some of them might take away, like, okay, if there's no attainment and no suffering, why are we doing this?
Exactly. Like, well, that's what Pema says. You know, they say they had heart attacks, and her view is some of them, yes, she says that. Maybe they just left, but some probably left. Some had heart attacks. Got up and, you know, forget this. But I think, again, the takeaway here seems to me is the contemplation for yourself.
If you think you can explain what's going on, you're wrong.
Can you see how hard this is? I think you guys get this.
Okay.
Well, everything in here is actually very useful to contemplate and work with.
Right.
For instance, the early part, form is emptiness, emptiness is also form. Emptiness is no other form. Form is no other emptiness. You know, this maybe this is something we could all think about in the coming weeks and try to understand how everything defines each other. In other words, you can't understand emptiness or even what you might be thinking about without understanding what form is. They define each other. So this is called interdependence, and it's an aspect of the shunyata or emptiness we're speaking of. Interdependence.
And when we say emptiness, we don't mean nothing, right? We don't mean
it doesn't mean
no thing. Yeah, that's not
a
vacuum.
It just means potential
for
something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I had a very interesting experience the other day. I had been away in New York, and I came back, and so I came back on, what day did they come back? Wednesday, I think. Wednesday. Yeah. No, Tuesday I came back.
Tuesday.
And so it wasn't until yesterday, which is Wednesday, that I looked out back and I realized a whole tree had been taken down. And up to that time, I literally saw the tree there because I had always seen the tree there. And you may have told me something about cutting down the tree, but it somehow didn't register. And I saw the tree there. And then yesterday I looked and it was gone. And I knew it hadn't been gone while I was there because I didn't hear anything. So really, it's amazing. And I started thinking about how we create our world with our mind. And that was the first experience I had of actually experiencing the tree was not there. I really saw that it wasn't there. But it was there even when it wasn't.
That happened at work today. The worker was like, oh, I'm going to work from home. And he's there at his desk. And he's like, do you guys even see me? And everyone turned to him. They're like, oh, you're here. I thought you were working from home today. Like, because they thought he
right.
wasn't going to be there. He just wasn't there to them. He was right next to them kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
See what you think you should be
right,
saying.
Exactly, because we preconceive. Our so much of our world is preconception. So this is about, I think, cutting away those concepts as much as possible where we can actually make more direct contact with reality. So when the Blessed One had said this, Venerable Shariputra and Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, that whole assembly and the world with its gods, humans, asuras, gandharvas, rejoiced and praised the words of the Blessed One. And these words, asura, these refer to this worldview of realms being populated with different beings. It's really a lot of older teachings were like that, sort of
spirits
yeah, yeah, levels of beings. Take this home if you want and contemplate it as much as you can, and know that it's a very advanced teaching.
How come yes. Buddha gets credit for what Avalokiteshvara says? Is it just because, like, he said it and the Buddha's like, yeah, that's pretty much right? Is that why?
Well, they talk. Well, actually, even
he
said it was exactly right.
He said it was exactly right. He said, okay, you said it right.
Right.
But you understand.
But it's his wisdom.
Behind the whole thing.
Right.
Shariputra, when he asks in the first place, is asking from his Buddha nature. His Buddha nature is already provoked into asking by being curious.
So we're not talking about the Buddha as a person. We're talking about, like, the Buddha as nature.
As a principle that's pervasive. Yeah.
Okay,
so the Buddha is not only a historical figure.
I'm thinking
of
them as people separately as opposed to... Okay.
Buddha is intrinsic awareness.
Mm-hmm. So Manish said something about tasting. What was it?
Sugar.
Okay. So you can put that into action with the heart sutra. You can notice in the next week, do you eat your meal or do you eat a concept of your meal?
Oh, yeah.
Do you actually know what your food is tasting like as you're eating it? Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Because very often we don't.
So this concludes the module 2. There are some more chapters we haven't discussed, so you can obviously read the rest of the book. I just wanted to say what's coming. Next week, Michael Fagan will give a talk on meditation practice and has some interesting aspects to share on that. And then the next 2 weeks after that, we're going to show a movie. It's going to be divided into two sections. It's called When the Iron Bird Flies. And this was a prophecy from a teacher that came from India into Tibet and actually established Buddhism in Tibet. And it's so the prophecy is when the iron bird flies, that's an airplane, because there was no word for airplane, Buddhism will be brought to the land of, did they say the land of the red man? It's something like that. Basically, the West, that's what it is. So it's a movie about Buddhism coming to the West and Western and teachers that have come here. So there are a number of different teachers that are shown. And we'll show it in two segments, 45 minutes each. So that will be in, not next week, but the week after. So the next 2 weeks in to the end of May. So that takes us to the end of May. And I'm trying to figure out what the next section will be on. Possibly we'll go into more detail on meditation as the path. So we'll have to see. But we will continue through the summer, and in the fall we'll probably start another teaching cycle, most likely the Hinayana path. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.